Did you pick your pants with secret when you left your office last night and you closed the door behind you? Were you walking in your sleep or were you just too tired to notice all the watchful eyes upon you? Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy. Tom Metzger right here in the bunker.
Hi, I'm Tom Metzger, your host for Race and Reason. We've been with you now since 1984, producing over 150 television shows, seen all over the United States in approximately 60 cities. Race and Reason is dedicated to freedom of speech, total freedom of speech. An island of free speech in a sea of controlled and managed news. Today we're quite fortunate. We have a man to appear on our show. His name is James Mason. He hails from Colorado. James Mason has had a long career in the National Socialist Movement, starting out when he was a teenager, and he is an author who has now published a book called Siege, 435 pages of hot revolutionary-style white propaganda. It's good to have you with us.
My pleasure, Tom. It's an honor.
All the way from Colorado.
Oh, yeah. Quite a trip over the mountains.
Oh, yeah. Let's start with, how old were you when you got involved with the racial movement?
13 years old, Tom.
And how did it go?
It was the time of the riots, the major riots in the cities. And every evening at the dinner hour, around 6 o'clock, you'd turn your TV on, and there they'd be, burn, baby, burn.
Was this in the 64?
This was the 65, 66 period.
I see.
And back then, every right-thinking, red-blooded white American was a right-wing Republican conservative type, and my family was certainly no different. And we just deplored all that business.
And you were shocked.
I was shocked. I was enraged, maybe even a little fearful of all this.
But most 13-year-old kids are out there riding their bikes and not really thinking much about anything. But you seem a little different type of 13-year-old kid.
I was a little more serious-minded.
Well, what did you do?
I guess my eyes started opening. You know, when you're 13, you start getting a little more independent in your thoughts, begin finding a few things out for yourself. And I graduated. I would go down to the news stand, and instead of buying comic books and so forth, I began buying World War II literature, anything having to do with Hitler or the Second World War, or anything pertinent to what was going on.
So, what do you think made the connection between being upset with the riots and becoming interested in Hitler?
I had always had a feeling down deep, and I even voiced it a few times in talks with my father, that it seemed to me, from what little I knew about the Second World War, that we fought on the wrong side in that war. From what I understood of it, that Hitler had attempted to smash communism, and instead we allied ourselves with the communists.
Yeah,
and
now
we had them all over us.
It does seem a bit strange, doesn't it? But
we
how
were
come
at that time bogged in Vietnam, which there couldn't have been had Hitler destroyed communism as he had wanted. It seemed obvious, too obvious.
So at 13, you pretty well figured that out.
Yeah, it was obvious.
And what did you do to act upon these feelings?
I continued to get my hands on everything I could dealing with Hitler. Of course, it was all slanderous material. I particularly enjoyed the pictorial stuff, the whole persona of the man.
There are a lot of young people I've noticed that are very much attracted to the German uniforms and the pictures and the battles and all that, but a lot of those people don't go on and become interested in the ideology.
Well, it started there with me, but it didn't stop there.
What did your parents think about this?
Well, they didn't know that much about it. They thought it might be a kid's passing interest until after I'd been in it close to a year, they began to notice these manila envelopes arriving in the mailbox for their son, marked Arlington, Virginia. No more return address than that. And it looked a little on the official side to be coming regularly for a 13 or a 14-year-old, so they opened one. I wasn't around when they opened it, but I can imagine they just about fainted.
And who was it from?
American Nazi Party headquarters, Arlington, Virginia.
That's quite a jump for a southern Ohio 13-year-old kid in school.
It didn't seem like much of a jump to me. It seemed the only logical thing to do.
So you joined the party?
It wasn't that easy finding them. I, first of all, became aware of their presence in September of 66, at the time George Lincoln Rockwell staged his march in Chicago through a black neighborhood to counter Martin Luther King's marches through white neighborhoods.
Was that the Cicero March?
That was the Cicero March. And that hit the news very big. And I saw that, and I said, what do you know? They're really here. They're for real.
And you figured out a way then to contact them.
Well, I didn't figure a way out. It just kind of it presented itself to me. When I went back into, that was in August and September of 1966, and I reentered school that fall, and rumors were there was this crazy kid who dressed paramilitary style, and he practically goose-stepped down the corridors, and he was a member of the American Nazi Party, or the Hitler Youth, or something of this nature. And I sought this fellow out, and I practically twisted his arm and make him give me that address. And the minute I had it, I applied for application for membership.
Did that person go on and become a stay in the movement?
No, he dropped off very, even before high school was through.
But that's two of you in a small school in southern Ohio, right?
Well, that was two of us, and before long it was four of us, and we had a nucleus of four in our little gang. And beyond that, there were more soft core hangers on.
Now, you were 13, 14 at the time, so you couldn't actually join the party, is that
true? At 14, you could. You could join the National Socialist Youth Movement, and that's exactly what I did.
I see.
And I was that for 4 years until my 18th birthday. I was at party headquarters. Even before the selective service at 18, I was at party headquarters signing up for full party membership.
So you... Now, how did it go in school? Were you open with your views?
Oh, very open, very open. Yeah, I got a lot of catcalls and a lot of ribbing, and didn't run into any violence or anything. I was a pretty big boy. One or two teachers took up my position, not the pro-Nazi position, but the fact the position that democracy was a fraud. I had a little help there.
So then at 18, then you moved on and went to the party headquarters?
Oh, I did that at 16.
At 16?
Yeah, it was the earliest. I was fed up with school. I knew I needed and wanted out of there because it was becoming a zoo even at that time in the 1960s.
Were they integrating there?
We had all, in southern Ohio, we had always been integrated.
Yeah.
But the blacks hadn't always been quite so black, if you know what I mean. They hadn't been letting it all hang out until all this liberation and freedom and brotherhood nonsense was being dumped on them in the 60s. And then they went wild
disintegrated. When I was in school in the 50s, there were a few black people in the school, but there was never any problems until the Civil Rights.
Yeah, they were black, but they acted white until the latter 60s.
But you went to party headquarters in Arlington, Virginia at 16. Did you happen to meet George Lincoln Rockwell?
No, because he was assassinated on August 25th, 1967, and I didn't turn 16 until the following year. And that's the earliest that I could have left home, left school, and sought employment.
Well, what happened when you walked into the Nazi headquarters?
Well, it wasn't that easy. I had been trying to get out of school, and they didn't want me out because I had set a strong example, and a lot of other guys were wanting out the same way. I had gotten myself suspended, expelled, or made a general nuisance of myself just trying to get out because they wouldn't let me out. I had to make them throw me out. They finally got wise to that, and they threatened me with jail, prison for boys. And I then got on the phone very quickly to Arlington, Virginia, and talked to one of the officers, and I said, I'm going to have to get out of here very quickly. Could you use another good hand down there? And he said, yes. Planned to see me Tuesday morning, and that was like day after tomorrow or something like that. And I took a Greyhound bus, and that was it.
What was your parents' involvement during this struggle with the school? Did they back you up, or did they sort of take a neutral position?
They learned very early that I couldn't be dissuaded. Once I determined a course, like as I said a moment ago, they had purloined a few of the early bulletins until I began to wonder where my mail was. I said, I should have been hearing from somebody here all along, what's going on with my mail? And finally, my father said, well, we've been keeping that, because he had been taking it around to the FBI, the police, even the American Legion, to see what could be done about it. And, of course, nothing could be done about it. It was legal. Then my mail started back up. So that was one battle. One.
So you get on the Greyhound bus and set out to the party headquarters.
Yeah.
What happened?
Got off the bus. Well, you know, got off the bus and I was completely disoriented. Total stranger, 16-year-old, first time away from home.
Never been out of Ohio?
Never been. Well, only in vacations with parents, you know, yeah. But never on my own. See, I was on my own now for the first time. I've got off at the 1600 block down there of Wilson Boulevard, and I'm looking around for the headquarters. And in fact, I'm looking up like this when I should have been looking down like that, because it was a very small building. And in fact, it got even smaller as it went back. It was on a sharp corner. So it went back to a point, and it was very cramped in there. They didn't have sufficient office space. This was their new headquarters. They had lost the old barracks on the hill, which they never owned. At least they owned this one. So I was kind of disappointed. And I went inside, and what a typically stag atmosphere that was. That was the style in those days.
In case you've joined us late, we have with us today James Mason, who has been a white activist, white separatist activist, and a confirmed National Socialist ever since he was 13 years old. And we're sharing today his evolving from 13-year-old kid in school into the National Socialist Party and what he was doing at that time working with the party. And if you'd like to communicate with Mr. Mason, you can write him at Storm Books. That's P.O. Box 18009, Denver, Colorado, 80218. So let's continue this sojourn here, James.
Okay, it was frustrating, Tom, in the beginning, because I was full of resentment at what was going on and happening in the country. With the black movement, the blacks going wild, tearing things up, the hippies, which I found to be totally disgusting, which a lot of my former friends and classmates were falling into that orbit, growing their hair. Mm-hmm. Dope was beginning to make the scene. I was going in the opposite direction, and I was outraged by all this.
And you wanted to do something real quick.
I wanted to do something to stop this.
Yes.
And I felt that Hitler's image was such that this was the group to do it. But unfortunately, those in charge at the time had other ideas. They were not a revolutionary movement. They were a conservative movement, thinking that all of this could be stopped dealing from within the system, from within the government and the establishment.
In other words, the National Socialist Party here in the United States at that time was more or less a conservative-type party with the swastika.
Absolutely. That's all it was.
Not really a National Socialist
Only
party.
In theory. They were good at giving you lectures. giving you literature to read, study up on Hitler and all this and that. But as far as putting it into practice, no. They would be, without the swastika, indiscernible from a dozen other right-wing groups.
So you became a little disillusioned? Or?
Very disillusioned, very dissatisfied, but I had no choice, it appeared, except to go along. And I had a lot to learn. There was no question about that. I had a lot to learn. I figured this is the place to learn it, and so that's what I did.
How long did you stay with them?
I was down there on the headquarters staff from 1968 through 1970. But I was a member of the organization for 10 years. I resigned in 1976.
And what happened when you took off from the headquarters? Where did you go?
Well, I went back to Ohio. And I helped at certain things were happening with the group then, even with their conservative approach. We had headquarters in Cincinnati and Cleveland and Akron, and I would go around and help out in these places. I would turn out for various major demonstrations around the East and things like that.
Were you around during the Skokie time when they were going to march in Skokie?
This was 76 or 77. This was a different group, however. This was a splinter group.
Oh, that's
in
true.
In fact, it was the first splinter group that turned into anything.
Yes. Yeah. And so you didn't look upon those as being legitimate?
Legitimacy, I had begun to recognize legitimacy as being something that would hold you back. Because after all, legitimate in the eyes of who? Effectivity is what we needed, not legitimacy.
What did you think about the Skokie March?
It was a grandstand play for publicity. And in the end, it exposed our weakness.
And they didn't march at all.
They didn't march, no.
Just publicity.
Just publicity, which I had stuck my neck out time after time after time with the Arlington group seeking publicity on the theory that if you show these people, that is the broad masses of Americans, that there is an alternative, give them a few facts they've been denied by the media, when things got bad enough, they would flock to us.
That's the conservative
approach.
That
was the theory. But in reality, that's compared to throwing a bunch of lumber and bricks up in the air, hoping that when they come down, you'll have a house. And it never quite worked.
There's plenty of groups that believe that today.
Well, they're stuck in the past.
Yes. Because how are you guaranteed? You're not guaranteed they'd even follow you anyhow.
No.
They say, well, why do we want to follow you anyhow? You know, this guarantee that they'll mass to your door.
And simply having the truth will not make you free.
That's true.
Only action. It has to be well-informed action, but it must be action.
Truth never released any slave.
That's right.
They took physical action.
Quite right.
So anyhow, what were your activities during that period? Trying to sort of go along with the program?
With that program, we staged the very first ever openly Nazi county fair booth at the Ross County, Ohio Fair in 1974. We did that, got a lot of publicity.
I bet the American Legion loved that one.
We got more publicity out of the fight to secure the right to have the booth than by actually having the booth. And we took a lot of abuse in the process, which I was never a big fan of taking abuse.
Were there any physical attacks?
They tried once or twice.
So you ran up the banner, the swastika at the county fair?
Yeah. And we were all in uniform. We had guys coming in from other parts of Ohio and as far away as Wisconsin. So we put up a very good show. But nothing positive came of it. It was a spectacular thing, and they're still talking about it today.
Well, it's spectacular that you completed your mission, I would think.
Well, spectacular for a town like that. Nothing had ever happened there. 10 years afterward, I still had people that I would be engaged in conversation with, and they would say, do you remember the time the Nazis had the fair booth? And I said, vaguely, I remember something about that. Tell me what happened. They said, was there trouble? And the person would say, well, the Nazis tried to create trouble. Yeah, they tried to create trouble, but the people of the town, no, they were fine.
What was the attitude you were experiencing from these other right-wing conservative groups as a National Socialist?
I didn't have much contact with them.
But did you read some of their material and so
Not
forth?
Not until years later, and I found them, if I found any of our own stuff to be weak tea, they were much worse.
And they were spending an inordinate amount of time attacking the National Socialists, too.
Yes, there was that, the infighting. We were all basically fighting over the same mailing list, trying for a bigger piece of the same pie.
It seems like in those days, like the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, and the Nazis wouldn't have anything to do with each other much, but it seems today there's a lot of cross-pollination between these various groups.
Reality is beginning to sink in. And all these petty differences are fading away, as they should.
And the leaders that try to keep just these little fiefdoms tend to be...
dying on the vine. They're becoming jokes. A young person drawn to the movement today, or as you would like to call it, the resistance, is much the same as I was. They want action. They don't want garbage. They don't want to be indoctrinated. Sure, you have to educate people. But they don't want indoctrination. They want to see a positive thing happening. They want to be part of something.
Well, then what happened after you did the fair bit?
Well, I had pulled one too many of the old grandstand play type things for publicity, and we were arrested by police. And being who we were, well, if it had been anyone else, nothing probably would have happened to them except maybe court costs. But being who we were and being that it had the resultant publicity, why, the city, the cowardly white city fathers were on the hot seat, and to get themselves off the hot seat, they had to give us the maximum six-month jail sentence.
So what was the charge?
It was an assault, a simple assault, whites on blacks.
Mm-hmm. In other words, a fight.
It was a fight, yeah. And I did 6 months in the Cincinnati workhouse with some days knocked off for good behavior. Mm-hmm. And it was while I was in the Cincinnati workhouse, I decided that this was the time and the place to either quit this, because if I didn't, I might wind up in the big house next time doing a felony on the same type thing, or get very serious about it, get serious with what I was doing and drop the nonsense and really get on with something worthwhile.
How old were you when you went into the workhouse?
22, give or take. I'm still a young person.
So so up until this point, you pretty much...
I paid my dues and I took my orders.
Did the party line. And,
right.
But by this time, you're beginning to question whether there might be other ways to go.
I had seen enough to convince myself that I couldn't do it any worse myself if I began to take it on my own.
So?
I had learned enough.
You're out of the workhouse?
Well, before I was out of the workhouse...
back.
While I was in the workhouse, I thought I'd put the time to good use, and I formulated a new political front to be activated upon release. And we called that, I had a few partners that were with the old units, and they were all of the same feeling that we had been spinning our wheels and needlessly risking our necks. So I knew I was going to have some support as soon as I got out, so I formulated the National Socialist Movement. We got away from all these silly party names and group names. And we wanted to have one blanket political front.
Now, was that complete with uniforms? And
no, if we ever used uniforms, and we seldom did, it was the old party uniform, the brown shirt, the black trousers, the red armband, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Nothing loud, because some of them were getting awfully loud. Some of them were wearing berets. Some of them were wearing red lanyards, boots, Sam Brown belts, and you name it, and they were beginning to look, white gloves, they were beginning to look like clowns. It was just a club, a boys' club, and they would dress up, you know, as strangely as the Masons or the Shriners or anybody else. It was anything else but a serious political movement. So we strove to avoid that.
Americans traditionally don't seem to be too uniform conscious.
No. Very, very anti-regimentation, very anti-uniform, and so that's the reality of the situation. And any who choose to go against that put themselves in a dream world of their own making.
Now, the National Socialist Movement reached out to all over the country?
We reached out to, at this point, it was 1975, and there was a lot of disaffection going on in the party now. There had already been the splinter in Chicago, as we mentioned, already in 1970, and they were doing quite well.
That was the Frank Collin group.
That was the Frank Collin group, National Socialist Party of America, and they were doing quite well with their own newspaper and their own activities. And then there was Joseph Tomasi, who headed the party group in Los Angeles. who was giving, had consistently given National Headquarters in Arlington a run for their money in terms of how many men he could throw on the street at a given signal for a demonstration, his effectivity as a speaker, as an organizer, and like that.
He was the out front man.
He was an out front man. He was a little too out front for the leadership. Jealousy set in.
So he got into trouble.
He got into trouble. A few stooges were dispatched out there to come up with infractions of certain silly rules, and Tomasi was hailed into a so-called court-martial. And while he wasn't drummed out of the party at that point, he was so insulted that he resigned. As anyone who was a real man at that point would have resigned.
Yes. So these, you're still sort of in some competition here in the NSPA and then this...
Well, we didn't want to be in competition with anyone because that was counterproductive.
Well, no, I don't mean it in a sense, a negative sense, but you were different organizations.
We were different organizations because I learned the way things were arranged at the time. If you wanted to work, you couldn't really work with someone. You could only work under someone. And therefore, if you had any talents or anything you could contribute on your own, it was going to be suppressed. Because as I was bringing in the Tomasi thing, jealousy would always kick in. These were more clubs than they were parties. They weren't parties at all. They were clubs, cults.
They weren't spending too much time getting ballot qualified.
They were worried about each other more than the real enemy because they didn't have what it takes to come to grips with the real enemy, so they fought among themselves, somebody more their own size.
Isn't that true of the left and all kinds of groups?
Sure it is. It's even the same between Democrats and Republicans.
Yes.
But the only people that are going to claim control of the future are those that can put that behind them and become disciplined revolutionaries.
And so the National Socialist Movement, how did it fare? I mean, did it grow?
Well, we saw what Joseph Tomasi did after he departed the party and he started the National Socialist Liberation Front in 1974, even before I went in to do my jail sentence. And some of the revolutionary propaganda and some of the revolutionary acts that they performed just inspired some of us.
So you began to become more attracted to that that phase.
Right. And I felt that to have joined Tomasi, and Tomasi was a very gifted and a very dynamic leader. He had the ego to go with it. That was all right. That was his prerogative. He earned it. But I knew that to try to work with him or under him, I wouldn't be able to make my full contribution. So that's why I started the National Socialist Movement. We could work independently, doing exactly what we wanted to do. And if we fell flat, we fell flat. If it was a success, then nobody else was going to be around to sabotage the effort.
Now, your support around the country was, did you have a reasonable support compared to the Central National Socialist Party?
It took off like a shot. There were a number of things we set ourselves to in the beginning.
I'm afraid we're going to have to hold it, though, James, till our next. You've promised me you're going to come back.
Absolutely.
Because you've got a lot of story to tell here.
Absolutely.
And for those of you who would like to write to James Mason, Storm Books, P.O. Box 18009, Denver, Colorado 80218. And this is the book, the hot new book, Siege, that he has written. And I think it's a monumental work of 435 pages. We want to thank you out there for joining us today and hope to see you soon. And let's talk about white revolution. Maybe it's the only solution.
Got the younger brothers, they got plenty of others, fool enough to cower and crawl, shackled and chained behind high walls. They say I've made more widows and orphans, enough to fill 20 coffins. They won't hear my side at all. If 16 grains of morphine could just wipe the slate clean, well, you know I would take it all. But rotten in the state of Minnesota, sweating on a chain gang of alive, not with my will to survive. We'll run them till they stumble and fall. I shall never spend a day behind.